Right. So when I think about the big data privacy work, I usually cast it in the context of communications as well, because I'm really in networking much more than in big data. And it's, the question of privacy is all about data. Or it's not all about data, but data is a big part of it. We have that problem in the communications field as much as the big data people do. We're collecting lots of data. We want to figure out ways to use it. Users may or may not want us to use it, and so forth. So I view this as a single problem space, happens to be coming from several different domains. The dilemma, as I said, is that, in fact, there's a lot of value in that data. When I go to these big data meetings, most of the agenda, or often all of the agenda, is all about all the wonderful things that can be done with lots of data. We all know that as well. There's lots that we can do with that data. We can run our businesses better. We can provide better services. We can sell things to people. We can give them better health outcomes and so forth. There's a lot going on. One of the huge issues, one of the huge trends in this day and age is all about using multiple data sets, fusing the data, and discovering new and interesting, wonderful things. There's also a buzzword that you may have heard called data lakes. The idea is increasingly large collections of data of all sorts that are pooled in one particular place or one particular service so that it's easier and easier to get at them. The other side, to me, is the cost in terms of privacy. What are the risks? What are the costs that are involved in doing this? To whom? And that question is certainly broader than just the subject, because the data is often incorporates information about other people and other organizations as well. Who has what rights in terms of privacy? Sometimes it's the individual, sometimes it's an organization. There are many different players. Who has responsibilities for making sure that privacy is supported to the best we can do it? And the question that we've been asking in the Big Data Privacy Working Group is, what's feasible now and where are we going? So, as I said, there are two groups that I'm involved in. One is the Security and Privacy Working Group here in the CFP, and the other is the Big Data Privacy Working Group, and I chair both of those, so I'm, in fact, in the process of merging them. Same set of issues, and I'm not going to repeat them all because we're running a little shorter on time than I had planned. The first document for which there is a pointer on the agenda, and I see that not many people actually got the there's a paper copy of the agenda outside if you would like it. Was a report on a large series of user scenarios. We just wanted to say, what are people seeing? What are the problems in this space? There are real problems. The people in the room divided themselves up into a set of areas that they found interesting. This is not intended to be all-inclusive or completely representative. It is representative of the things that people were interested in at the time in the group. So there are seven different scenarios that people spent some time working on, some more, some less. The first three actually got more intense scrutiny than the other four, but they are all summarized in that document. It's a long document. I don't expect people to read all of it, but there is an executive summary. And I would what I'd like to do here is talk about one of those scenarios and just one piece of it, because it was crossing the boundary between big data problems and communication problems. The particular situation that they were looking at was in African countries, and they didn't say which countries, and I'm perfectly fine with that. NGOs and ministries of health were interested in understanding whether there was mobile phone data that would help them address some of the problems of infectious disease. And in particular, there were two alternative scenarios that they considered. One was simply understanding the mobility of people back and forth through areas where, with high infection rates, back perhaps home to their perhaps less infected areas, to understand trajectories of infectious diseases. And the other was a question of whether they could micro-target individuals for intervention. And those have very different implications in terms of privacy, in terms of how they handle the data. So they wanted to just look at that comparison. The data includes not only location and distances traveled, duration and frequency of travel, a few things like recharging patterns, because that tells you something about the economic situation of the individuals involved. If they're recharging a lot, then they probably have more money and they have more access to electricity. There were ways of inferring things about people that are interesting, and one of the things that we see frequently in terms of dealing with data, what can you learn about people and to what extent is that useful and or an invasion of privacy? Texting patterns as well, clearly. Let me just go to the next slide, actually, because there were three categories of participants in this besides the subjects themselves who actually don't show up here. There's the mobile network operators, and there were many of those, or at least more than one. A model of a single third-party aggregator of the data, and then a set of users, clients of the data, the ministries of health and NGOs. If you look at this, let me go back to this. If you look at this example, there are several different places where if you think you want to make the data more private, that might occur, and it comes back to who's responsible and who knows. One of the models that they talked about, in one of the models, the MNOs themselves were responsible for masking data so that it was de-identified and as much as possible made more private, which means that the third party provider in the middle couldn't identify individuals particularly. The other model was that the MNOs themselves would simply pass all their data to the third party provider, and the third party provider would do any masking of data provision of privacy. One hopes that the ministries of health and so forth would behave properly too, but their model was that there were these two different alternatives in terms of system design. What's hard in this space? This sounds like a really simple model. So the MNOs just do their thing, they anonymize the data, and the individuals are protected. If they don't, then the ministry, then the third party can do it, and then you have the opportunity to do that micro-targeting. Regulatory environment, really complicated. There are two very different traditions in that part of the world, the French civil code and the British common law code. They have very different models of privacy. They have very different models of how you handle data. And people don't respect those boundaries. They walk across those boundaries all the time. They walk to their family who may happen to live in a different country, which may be under a different regime, which means all of a sudden the data about them now is crossing a regulatory boundary for which we don't have a good solution to how you deal with privacy and what your constraints and requirements are. The question of the utility of the data and the amount of work that has to be done and privacy. Sometimes to do some of this work takes a lot of work. And in particular, the MNOs do not have experience and were not, typically are not expected to have to deal with how do I deal with my data in terms of whether or not it is going to provide privacy in terms of medical histories. That's not a question they ask. They don't know how to do it. So it's a very, the technical design is easy. All the policy questions and the organizational questions are much more complicated. In the report at the end, we talk about a number of observations that we made that derive from this set of scenarios. Scale is clearly a problem. Diversity of stakeholders and interests and objectives increasing all the time, just becoming increasingly more complicated. Integration, as I said, fusion across multiple data sets that originally were collected for very different purposes with different kinds of information in them means that facts about individuals suddenly start emerging that were unpredictable or unpredicted originally. The question of secondary subjects. If grandma goes to the doctor and she's taken there by her daughter, then all of a sudden the daughter's presence at the medical center may become a piece of the medical record. And does the daughter also have control over what kinds of privacy policies are imposed on the data that happens to include some facts about her, but in fact is primarily about grandma? Hard question. And as I said, the final point is this question of emergent information out of fused data sets especially, which probably requires emergent policies, just because this data over here has one policy and that data over there has another policy, doesn't mean, am I at 25 minutes already, Dave? I was counting down, thank you. Okay, good. Doesn't mean that when we start inferring facts across those data sets that the policy that will, that should be or might be applied is necessarily simply a product of the two existing policies. That data, in fact, is something that we didn't expect, and the policies about them probably needs to be something different. I don't know how to do that. I think that is a very hard problem. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know how we, it's, in any case, it was an interesting observation that came out of this. The other thing that we did was we went, as in going through these, all these scenarios, came up with a starting point for a list of stakeholders, because we decided that that was actually critically important. Who's involved, who gets to set policies, who cares about the policies, who enforces the policies. I'm not going to run through this list, but what we were trying to do was tease apart all the different roles that are involved in handling data, and in particular in handling data in places where privacy may become an issue. Okay, so the next thing, that's the report that, that exists. The next thing we are setting out to do, and we, the work is still in progress, is to start talking about the technologies that might help address some of this. This is not a done deal. It is not that differential, if you if you import some differential privacy policy algorithms, that in fact you're all done. There are many questions in this space. One has to do with what technologies are available, are coming along, where are they applicable? And for each one of these technologies, there is some applicability and some not. If you look at differential privacy, there are some, it's only useful under certain conditions. It's important for our, for us to understand what those are and to understand the limitations of it. Where are they in the trajectory from theoretical research to being in practice? There are a couple people who are, there are groups who are using differential privacy. As I keep coming on onto that because that's one that people actually have heard the name of a lot. But there are some huge problems with using it. It's not that it's a done deal. So can we frame the utility of these things? Can we understand where there are options, where there aren't options yet, and there's still further work to do? And that is the next report. It has to do with what technologies are and aren't available and what their restrictions are. So when we think about data, there are kind of two broad categories of data that we think about. This is not the way, the only way of thinking about all of this problem space. We've been trying to figure out how to tease apart the framing of it. And if you have other thoughts, I am more than well, more than open to different ways of thinking about it. But one way of thinking about it is that there are situations in which we want aggregate results, as and there are other situations where we want individualized results. Those will have very different implications for the individual. They probably have very different implications for what kinds of technologies you use in order to achieve them. So that's one way of dividing up the world, is to think about the individuals versus the aggregate results. The other is to think about the points in the data cycle, in the use of the data, or the collection and use of the data, management of the data, where policies can be applied and what those might look like, what kinds of technologies we have for them. And for the most part, we are focusing, and I'm going to focus in this talk on this second set of components of the framing. So when we think about data collection as the primary, the starting point, it's all about who gets to decide what those policies are, how they get to express those. Online notice and consent is one form of that. Informed consent, where somebody actually has to click through and say, yes, I understand. Setting of personal attributes. We've all tried to do this in Facebook. It's not easy often. How do you do that effectively and well, and how does it persist? Human review, the IRBs and review boards that actually look at this kind of thing and what people are doing with their data, that's something that is separate from the subject. That's a different group of people who get to decide what those policies are and where they, how they ought to be applied. And finally, there is some work on starting to think about, can you infer people's interests in policy from their behaviors? So there's some machine learning kind of things, technologies going on here that are trying to figure out what do you as an individual care about in terms of your policies, with a hope that especially in some of these fused data situations, you might be able to, the system might be able to figure out more about what you care about without having to come back and ask you every time something happens. Very complicated for the user. There's in each of these pieces, I'm going to talk about the approaches and some challenges. These are not all the challenges. This is, as I said, a quick review. It's very complicated. It's often very disruptive. Users often feel like they have no choice. I don't know about you, but every time I have to sign one of those HIPAA forms, my reaction is, well, I could get my medical care or I could not. And if I get my medical care, I have to sign away my rights. I don't have a lot of choice in that. I mean, I could continue to be sick or I could not. That's my only choice. So there's the usability of these things, the user friendliness, the user understanding is a really hard space, and that shows up at this beginning point where you're talking about collections. Doesn't capture what might happen in the future unless you come back to the user, and that's even more complicated, and they aren't always available. I'm going to move on because I don't want to run out of time, but there are lots of challenges in this space. A lot of them have to do with usability. Access control, data access control, the application of particular policies to specific data resources. Sometimes there are data use agreements. We certainly see that in networking and networking research when, you know, if I try to use certain data sets, I have to agree to the usage of it. I have to agree not to de-anonymize it and so forth. Digital rights management, there's a move afoot to do something called data tagging. I'm not convinced it gets you very far. It's pretty inflexible. It's pretty limited in terms of functionality, but it's simple. It makes it easier to understand. There is work clearly in the network area in terms of authentication and authorization, all the OAuth and access control work. And then there's a fair amount of work in encryption. I'm going to come back to encryption, various forms of encryption throughout this. Functional encryption is a very interesting part of the capability that exists in this space. It has to do with the fact that can I apply a function to data that is encrypted without decrypting it, get results that themselves are encrypted, so that the data is never in the clear, gives you a degree of privacy that you might not be able to get otherwise. This has a lot of problems. Key management. Tagging is too simplistic. Lack of extensibility in many of these cases. Functional encryption is very computationally intensive. So it gets you more, but it also costs you a lot. How do we think about that? And how does a provider of data or a controller of data actually think about those kinds of trade-offs? The next stage in dealing with data is processing and analysis. And here we talk about three different kinds of processing. One is simply access to the data, and has the data, for example, had the PII removed, the personally identifying information. Pretty simplistic, not very effective. If you go back and read all of Tanya Sweeney's work, it's very clear that there's a lot you can learn even from de-identified data. Statistical anonymization, such as K-anonymity, which is her answer to that, which is blur the data in such a way that you can't effectively know, at least within some bounds, who is whom. Managing individual queries. Sandy Pentland here at the Media Lab has been working on a project called Personal Data Stores. The idea is to give the individual control of the data themselves so that they can decide whether or not their data gets used in any particular situation. It's not perfect, but it's just a different way of thinking about the problem that changes the balance of who's in control, at least in some situations. Once I've given the data out to somebody, it's much harder for me to keep control of it, but at least up front, the individual has control. Secure multi-party computations in which in a multi-party computation, there's a single result that is intended from the set of all of the from a set of sources, but each one cannot know through the computation the results that each of the others is contributing to that. And again, this is a technology and algorithmic approach. It, among other things, has high computational overhead as well. And then a number of statistical approaches that either involve just statistically modifying the data or building models, statistical models of the data, and then synthesizing whole new data sets that have the same characteristics by some metric of the same characteristics. Again, these are all things, these are in progress. They are not perfect. They solve particular problems, and they have a number of challenges. For example, let me go back to the differential privacy one. The data has to be static because I do a computation over it. It's got to be a set that isn't, it's not streaming data. It's not data that's evolving. It's a static data set. The data must be large enough to hide the individuals in it, because the idea is that if I take one individual out or not, I cannot know I cannot know from the results of doing the computation with or without that individual whether the individual is there. I can't know anything about the individual from making that kind of a choice. The data has to be large enough, it has to be diverse enough. And there is this idea that there is an epsilon which defines how private it can be. Nobody knows how to define that epsilon. They pick pretty arbitrary numbers. I listened to an interesting talk not long ago from some people from Google who were using differential privacy. And when you say, so how did you pick epsilon? They said, well, we picked an arbitrary number, and it sort of worked. Not very convincing yet. So there's work to do here. It's not that this is bad. It's just that it's in progress still. Compliance and monitoring. Again, there are several things going on here. One is the accountable systems work that some of which is, a big part of which is happening actually in CSAIL. It comes out of the Distributed Information Group, DIG, who are also involved in the Hewlett work, thinking about how do you build systems that really have accountability in them. If you think that privacy isn't possible but you want to know after the fact so that you can have recourse, you need accountability. It's an interesting problem space. I think they also have some heavy lifting to do before it's actually at a point where we can use it. Huge scaling problems. If I'm collecting information about how data is used forever and ever because I always want recourse, I can't do that forever. I have a small data item and it's going to build a history over a lifetime. Not feasible. How do you think about, how do you aggregate, how do you abstract, how do you summarize, how do you selectively choose out of a history so that you can figure out what data you want to keep? Questions of trust come up here all over the place, and I'll come back to trust later. Separately, there's some work that's being done at Microsoft, in particular, which is a combination of something called legalese, which is a language of formalization of legal policies into something that is, Jeanette Wing is involved, so you can guess it's got data abstractions in it. Very nice capability. It means that in their underlying system, Grok, they actually do strong type checking to make sure that the policies are being applied the way you want it to be. It's particular to a MapReduce kind of set of functionality, so it's limited in the capabilities so far, at least. It's also static. It's compile time. Does that actually, you know, that means you can solve certain kinds of problems and there are other kinds of problems that you can't solve. Data destruction, end of life. This is an area where we've been struggling with how to think about it. One of the issues for privacy is how do I get rid of it? And when I look at that, I say, okay, so why do I want to get rid of it? I may want to actually cause it to go away because I don't want it there anymore. You know, I want to delete my Facebook account. I don't want to be present anymore. For that, one of the proposals that I found that looked interesting to me that wasn't actually carried through, but it's an interesting starting point, was some work by Simpson Garfinkel in his PhD thesis, and in one small workshop paper, so it's a little hard to find, in which he proposed that you give data a fade-out time, and you cause it to fade out by progressively, statistically dropping one increasingly more of the bits of the key, which means that slowly over time it becomes harder and harder to get at the data until you can't get it at all when the key is no longer available. There are some huge technical problems. It was never built. It's just an idea. There's other work on the question of how do I forget stuff when I just have too much of it? Maybe that's useful for the accountability kinds of people. How do I figure out when and how I should start summarizing, aggregating, selectively deleting, maybe through statistical choices? There's some work being done in that area. The third area that I find very interesting that also has to do with forgetting is in the machine learning situation where I've got a large data set that I've learned on, and maybe after the fact I discover that there was some bad data in there. Can I unlearn that without having to go back to the beginning and relearn everything from scratch with that bad data eliminated? And in this work, the people who are doing it are keeping summaries. As they're doing the machine learning, they're also keeping summaries in such a way that you can subtract the bad data from the summary and recompute and get much greater efficiency. Still, lots of hard problems in this. How do you figure out what should be deleted, when it should be deleted? How do you trust that the deletion is actually happening correctly? Okay, so, good timing. When I look at this, I think about the fact that there are a number of cross-cutting and open problems in this space. One has to do with metrics. Really hard problem. We don't know how to measure stuff, but we're starting to see lots of metrics in this space, and I've mentioned some of them. But it's first important to notice, although people will say, do you have privacy or do you not, it's not binary. You have degrees of privacy, or you have, you know, is it scalable? Maybe there are different kinds of privacy. I'm not sure. Well, there certainly are, when you go back to the legal system in the United States, there are a number of different torts, different models of how to define privacy. I don't want to go back to those. I've talked about those in other of these meetings. We don't have time for that. That's a long, long story. But privacy is not binary. Privacy is dynamic, and it's typically context sensitive. I care, you know, there's certain information that I will say in a doctor's office that I would not say sitting in my office or in the bank or in other situations. The privacy that I care about is different in different places and different contexts. As I've mentioned in here, there are a number of different metrics that are starting to pop out of a lot of this, partly because it's algorithmic. K-anonymity, L-diversity, a term that probably doesn't get quite as much popularity. It's a next step beyond K-anonymity, because the K-anonymity people, or the L-diversity people, discovered that there were some flaws in K-anonymity and some serious problems with not providing enough anonymity in the standard K-anonymity. That epsilon that I mentioned in differential privacy. There's been some work that Joan Feigenbaum has been doing on privacy approximation. She realized that you can't get perfect privacy, but can you start thinking about and understanding how to approximate it and how to measure, how to build a metric for privacy. Very theoretical work, nowhere near anything practical at this point, but it's just interesting that we're moving down that path. And then there's also been some information theoretic work on modeling disclosure risk. And again, very theoretical, not ready for prime time in terms of building systems. What's missing from all this? Well, people. I haven't really talked a lot of people about people. I've talked about the data. So people are involved in setting policies at all of these stages that I've talked about. How do they get involved? How do they interact? And how do we balance what they need? You know, I think about my sister, the artist, and if I tried to explain to her why she should or shouldn't let Microsoft or Apple know all about all of her apps that happen to fail when Steve wants NetInfo to send the information to everybody, or, you know, let the vendors send the information to everybody, she's not going to understand that. How do we inform and educate, and I know that's a difficult word to say, the user population who are the subjects? They don't always have control. You know, when it comes to some of your medical records or data that phone companies are collecting about how their networks are operating. You know, my cell phone company does get to collect data. I don't have any choice in that, but hopefully there are regulations and there are people involved in setting those policies and understanding how they are applied. People involved all the way throughout this. Each one at each stage will have models, will have understandings, will have responsibilities, both legal and social responsibilities. Huge problems in this space, and I have not talked about them other than to point them out. Trust. I haven't talked about trust. Trust pervades this. How do we figure out who we can trust to do all of these kinds of things and whether they are doing it accurately? They have to understand the risks, they have to understand the costs, which are different from the risks, and they need to understand the value, or we need to understand the value, in terms of providing trust. who are we trusting to do what? We don't trust, I don't trust my doctor with my financial data. I don't trust my bank with my medical data. I choose different people, different services, different capabilities to trust with different in different ways. There is some early work, not so early anymore, work on trust frameworks specifically applied to identity management. I haven't found trust frameworks applicable broadly to data, but that information management, identity management space is a place where trust frameworks are starting to come into existence, so we can start looking at those and understand the what are the issues in terms of trust frameworks. I think this is my last slide. Yeah, that's my last slide. Okay, so just to wrap up, notions of privacy are evolving. It's definitely not binary. The whole data cycle is important. It's not the only story, but it's the one I focused on here. Trust, as I said, is critically important. We don't have a good handle on it. And understanding the some of the negative social implications. Some of these kinds of technologies may increase the opportunity for various kinds of discrimination. Some of them may have a significant impact on freedom of speech. Some of them may reduce the opportunities for anonymity in exchange for providing privacy. Understanding those implications is a really, for me at least, a really hard space. Okay. I would welcome any of you who would like to join our effort in talking more about privacy. As I said, I'm reinvigorating the Big Data Privacy Working Group and integrating it with the Security and Privacy Working Group in the CFP. And we have 57 seconds. Okay, Andy.
You talked about Sandy's thing about owning your own data.
Yeah.
Which I think I had a student who did some work on that as well. But I don't understand how you get there from here. You know, like, I mean, right now Facebook and all these other guys want to own my data.
I agree with you. You're running a project. Maybe you could tell us how you get there from here.
I am not convinced
that you can get there from here. You know, a certain amount of my data I keep on my phone. You can't get at it. I don't share, my address book on my phone is not my address book that's in the service because I don't want it. Every time I upgrade any of my Apple devices, Apple wants me to use iCloud. No, thank you, I don't do it. But most people do. I don't know how you get there from here. Yes, Sharon.
I'm just curious whether your group has discussed economic solutions like, you know, I put a price on my private information, and I can set the knob really high if I'm concerned, and really low if I love getting things for free.
So I think that my understanding is that actually is part of Sandy's starting point for his work, because he was involved in the World Economic Forum report on personal data and the value of it, and having some of that value reside with the individual subject. It's a tough one. It comes back in part to Andy's question of how do you get control of that data in the first place, and then can we build a market in which I can choose to set high values on my data, and only if somebody is willing to pay that value, am I willing to share it? I still have many of the problems of how do I then keep control of it. Once I've shared it, once I've let that information out, I still lose control of it unless we have yet much more mechanism to make that feasible. It's a hard problem.